From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, analyzing the EAA, what's working, what's not, and why.
You have a sense of the kids being subjected to something different against the will of many in the community who would have preferred for the schools to remain under local control.
The centuries-old legend of the Nain Rouge turning into a modern-day graphic novel and film.
This is part of our folklore, so everyone owns it. It's the Nain Rouge was the steward of the Straits. We're the stewards of the story.
And we go back to November 1964 to one of the biggest games in the long rivalry between Michigan and Ohio State.
It was crucial for Michigan to win that game, not only just to win the Big Ten championship, but also to reassert its claim to being a strong team in the rivalry.
Those stories and much more today on Stateside. The Education Achievement Authority is in year three and still one of the most polarizing issues in Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today on Stateside, the EAA, what's worked, what hasn't, and why. Plus, a new graphic novel brings the Nain Rouge to life.
So we're really focused on now the future of storytelling, because stories are only powerful if they're shared and if they're told.
But first, Michigan election results became official today. The Board of State canvassers met in order to certify the results. One thing is certain, even without the board certification, and that is voter turnout was low in 2014. The lowest, in fact, for a governor's race since 1998. With that comes some interesting consequences. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta of our It's Just Politics team are here to explain. Hello, you two.
Hi, Cindy.
Hi, Cindy.
So low voter turnout. We say it's bad, that it impacts democracy. People's voices aren't being heard. But it also has another impact here in Michigan.
It does indeed. And that is, it will now be easier to get
slightly
a question
easier
on the ballot. Slightly easier to get a question on the ballot.
And that is because proposals in Michigan are, by and large, put on the ballot by petition drives.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature can also put questions on the ballot, but it's more typical for voters to do this via petition drives. There are a few different reasons to initiate a law, to amend the state constitution, to challenge a law that was just passed by the legislature. And the number of signatures required to do one of those things is based on the number of people who voted in the previous election for governor.
So you can see where we're going with this, right? Fewer votes in 2014 means fewer signatures needed to get on the ballot in 2016.
So voter-initiated laws require signatures equal to 8% of the vote for governor. Now, you can do the math at home, or we could tell
we'll
you,
do it for
that,
you
that
do it for us.
Is now, because of low turnout, reduced by 5,941. And if you think that this is just an academic exercise, well, consider this, that just this year, a proposal to enact a voter-initiated law to increase the state's minimum wage fell short by about 3,900 signatures. But thanks to low voter turnout, if those petitions had been turned in next year, the minimum wage question would actually make the 2016 ballot.
I see. So what do you think this means for 2016?
Well, let's look at some of the possibilities, shall we? Rick, how about fracking?
Mm. Oh, sure. Well, you know, fracking, that petition drive came short the last time around. Wolf hunting, that depending on how things go with various legal challenges, that would be another one up for a petition drive. Same-sex marriage, depending on what the United States Supreme Court does. There are a few other ballot drives that were out there that tried and came up short recently.
There were. And also, let's look, how about to this legislative lame duck session, Cindy, as we've talked about with you here on Stateside, adding LGBT rights and protections to the Elliot Larson Civil Rights Act. A lot of folks want to get that passed here in the lame duck.
If it doesn't happen, though. They're ready to go to the ballot in 2016, and it's just a little bit easier now.
Mm-hmm. Well, when you say that, 5,941, and then you put in that context, you know, to realize that minimum wage initiative was only 3,900 signatures short.
And so it's going to be interesting to see whether this suddenly has more grassroots organizations. Maybe we'll see something like the part-time legislature push be reignited again.
Yes.
And so all of this is going to make that a little easier. So it's interesting to note, right, that we're sort sort of so sad about democracy and the fact that we had such low voter turnout. But there is this sort of interesting, I don't know if I want to call it a silver lining.
Well,
but this idea that, hey, it's going to make for some folks, for some citizens who want to create some laws, who want to put some questions on the ballot, a tiny bit easier come 2 years from now.
Mm-hmm. Zoe Clark and Rick Pluta, hosts of It's Just Politics on Michigan Radio. As always, thanks so much.
Thank you, Cindy.
Oh, it's always a pleasure.
The debate over many political issues happening this year will continue. And as we just mentioned, one of those issues is the wolf hunt. Meredith Gore is an associate professor of fisheries and wildlife at Michigan State University, and she's co-lead author of a new study examining the attitudes driving the wolf debate in Michigan. Welcome, Meredith.
Thank you very much for having me.
What were you looking for in this study? I guess I'm wondering what insights that you wanted to add to the wolf debate.
Sure. Well, my co-author, Michelle Lute, and I were really interested in trying to better understand why controversy can and does persist in wolf management in Michigan.
In your study, you weren't trying to prove one side or the other's view. You were looking for what?
Well, we wound up conducting interviews with a group of 21 individuals who are very knowledgeable about wolf management in Michigan. We were interested in exploring how these key players think about the association between knowledge and power in wolf management. So, you know, wolves have been delisted in Michigan, but there's a long history of public involvement with wolf management in Michigan. So now that wolves were delisted, how has the role or the relationship between knowledge and power changed, and what are some of the assumptions that people are making about knowledge in politics in wolf management? If we can better understand this with more information, more understanding, we can increase our capacity to reduce conflict among wolf-related stakeholders in Michigan.
And Meredith, you really went across the board, didn't you, interviewing these stakeholders from bear hunters to animal welfare activists to livestock owners to biologists to tribal members. And did you hear themes as you interviewed these stakeholders?
We did. It was really interesting. We wanted to get stakeholders representing diverse views about wolves in Michigan, and we did find that there were assumptions that these groups did make in common. So one of the assumptions that we found is that there can be a tension between local knowledge and scientific knowledge. And this tension can be undermining trust in the decision-making process. And that may be one of the things that is potentially fueling controversy around wolf management in Michigan. We also found that the different folks that we interviewed, some people felt that politics really has no place in wildlife management. They kind of thought that science and politics should be completely separated. And so we wonder, you know, maybe there isn't such a black and white situation. Wildlife management decisions are made within a broader political context, and agencies are created by and contingent upon legislatures. So even though politics and science are both related to wolf management in Michigan, a lot of stakeholders think that they should be separate or that they currently are separate. Finally, one other thing that we found related to this idea of power, and that different stakeholder groups yield power, and this really influences the way that people perceive the decision-making process about wolves.
Tell me what you mean by that, when you say different stakeholder groups yield power.
Right. So one of the things that we were interested in looking at in this study was how stakeholders think about control over decision-making processes and also who has authority about decision-making processes. Now, these were also the main topics of the referenda, right? I mean, the referenda were focused on wolf hunting and decision-making authority. And so in our research, we found that one theme that cut across all these different stakeholder groups is that these folks felt that the role of power and special interest groups really influences the way that others perceive how fair decision-making processes are, and how transparent they are and how effective they are. This idea that there are certain groups that have special interests, and these special interests override concerns that minority interests may have, and these groups have undue influence. Another theme that we found in our interviews was this idea of the Native American perspective and their kind of interests being disenfranchised throughout the decision-making process.
So, Meredith, what now? Is there common ground that you sense that could be used to kind of, I don't know if the word settle the wolf management question is the right word to use, but to try to attack this very, very contentious issue?
Well, I'm an optimist, so I think the short answer is yes. I think that there is a way to increase our capacity to resolve conflict. I think that we can collectively work to recognize that science and politics can be compatible in some situations. We can also work to consider both local knowledge and scientific knowledge throughout wildlife decision-making processes. And we can also really work to try to boil down our decisions to a single point or a single interest. And I think that broadening that perspective may help reduce conflict as well. So I think there are opportunities that definitely await us.
Meredith, thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Meredith Gore is an associate professor of fisheries and wildlife at Michigan State University. And the study that she was lead co-author of is in a recent issue of the Journal of Wildlife Management. Here at Stateside, we really, really like to hear from you. What issues are you focusing on and stories are on your mind? Just let us know. We're on Twitter at Stateside Radio. You can find us on Facebook, where in case you missed it, you can check out our series that leading up to Thanksgiving, all about food. Or check out other stories or interviews you may have missed, michiganradio.org, and click the link that says Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. This Saturday brings one of the deepest, most storied rivalries in all of college sports, Michigan versus Ohio State, as the Wolverines head to Columbus. Bruce Galehood is a history professor at Ball State University and the author of Bump Elliott, The Michigan Wolverines and Their Championship Football Season. Welcome to the program, Bruce.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
Tell us what was so special and crucial for both Michigan and Ohio State about the game you're writing about, November 21st, 1964.
That game decided the Big Ten championship that year. It was unusual when you consider other Michigan-Ohio State games that there was suspense building right on through the season, and then there would be this final game that would decide the outcome of the Big Ten season. But this particular season, 1964, was one where Michigan and Ohio State and Purdue were sort of in it right up until the next to last weekend of the season, and then Purdue got beat by Minnesota. That left Michigan and Ohio State to play their final game, and the winner of that game was going to be the winner of the Big Ten, and they were going to go to the Rose Bowl. So the whole Big Ten season was really in doubt until that last shakeout occurred with the Purdue loss, and then we're faced with the Michigan-Ohio State game for the Big Ten championship. In some respects, it's almost kind of a precursor to all of the games that transpired in the late 60s and early 70s, where the final game of the season between Michigan and Ohio State was going to determine the outcome of the entire season and the trip to the Rose Bowl.
And in terms of the rivalry between the two, OSU versus U of M, Ohio State had been kind of on a pretty hot streak in the decade leading up to this game, hadn't they?
Absolutely. Ohio State had pretty well taken control of that particular rivalry in the 50s. Michigan, of course, dominated it in the early years, and then there was a relative degree of parity in the 20s and the 30s, and then Michigan pretty much took control of it right after World War II and the six games between about 45 and 51. But then Ohio State got the upper hand during the 1950s, and in 1964, Ohio State was riding about a four-game winning streak into that particular game. So it was crucial for Michigan to win that game, not only just to win the Big Ten championship for the first time in 14 years and go to Rose Bowl, but also to reassert its claim to being a strong team in the rivalry.
And as you point out in your piece for Michigan History, Bruce, the game was media-wise kind of off of everyone's radar for
right.
A couple big reasons, wasn't it?
That's right. One reason, of course, was that it wasn't clear that they were going to be playing for the Big Ten Championship until the last week of the season. Another reason was both Michigan and Ohio State had used up their two allotted television games, so the game wasn't televised except a couple local broadcasts, one out of Detroit, one out of Ohio, that reached very limited audiences. At least in Michigan, it was not covered extensively because the two major newspapers in Detroit, the Detroit News and the Detroit Free Press, were on strike. They had been on strike since July, and once the dispute was settled, the newspapers came back out to report on the football season, but it didn't come until after the Michigan-Ohio State game had been played. So you're right. It was not a well-covered, longly anticipated game like those that came after.
As we look at this game, November 21st, 1964, it's pretty ironic that a big chunk of Michigan's talent came from Ohio.
That's right. When Bump Elliott became the head coach at Michigan in 1959, it was pretty clear that Michigan had to start recruiting better. It had to start getting a higher level of football talent into its program if it was going to compete for Big Ten championships. And he even said he expected 3 to 5 years before Michigan would get the level of talent to compete for the Big Ten championship. So Bump Elliott and the Michigan coaching staff aggressively recruited in Michigan, Illinois, and Ohio, and especially in Ohio. There were a lot of Ohio players who started coming to Michigan in the early 1960s, and by the 1964 season, they were making their mark in the lineup. 11 of the 22 starters on the Michigan team were from Ohio, including 8 on offense. So I guess you have to say that the Michigan coaching staff's efforts to recruit were really starting to pay off.
And I love the quote you shared with us from Coach Bump Elliott, and that was, "I don't think we should call those boys Ohioans. Once they crossed the state line and entered Michigan, we forgave them completely and absolutely." So
that is a great quote. That's a great quote, isn't it? But he was serious about it. And if you read that quote from that Detroit Free Press article, there's no question about the loyalties of the Ohio players on the Michigan team. They were Michigan players. And, you know, as the preparation for that game, the Michigan players from Ohio knew their counterparts from Ohio who played at Ohio State. And so they knew what these various players on Ohio State could do. They had played against them in high school, or in some cases they had been teammates with them and that sort of thing. So it wasn't a surprise when they went head-to-head against Ohio in terms of understanding what the capabilities of those players on Ohio State were.
So let's take it to the field on November 21st, 1964. What right. worked well for Michigan?
Michigan had a great defense that year. And so in this game here, they knew it was going to be a defensive struggle because Ohio State was a strong defensive team. So they were geared in that direction, and they were very confident that they could hold Ohio State's offense. And Bob Holloway, who was the defensive coordinator for Michigan, actually told his players the night before the game, "Aim for a shutout. We can stop Ohio State." Ohio State had several occasions during the game, including about 3 or 4 in the first half alone, where they got the ball either on a Michigan turnover or a short punt in Michigan territory, and they weren't able to convert. And they had 3 chances where they could have really had as many as 3 touchdowns, 21 points on Michigan in the first half, but the Michigan defense stopped them. And then the Michigan offense was able to score in the last 2 minutes of the first half, and then in the second half, Michigan really dominated. The defense stopped them, the offense controlled the ball, they added a field goal, and Ohio State found themselves behind 10-0 about 5 minutes into the fourth quarter, and they just weren't able to come back at all.
So Michigan not only had themselves a win, they had a shutout. And you describe what happened when the Wolverines flew home in triumph and landed at Willow Run. Take us there.
Right. The plane was supposed to come into Ann Arbor a little bit after 6 o'clock at night, and they landed at Willow Run Airport. By then it was dark, and it was cold, and all of a sudden they discovered that there were thousands of people waiting for them at Willow Run. Now, the week before, they had beaten Iowa in Iowa City. It's interesting because it was really cold in Ohio. It was cold in Michigan on that particular day, November 21st, but the weekend before they played in Iowa, it was 70 degrees. There was a crowd of roughly, some estimates, 400 to 500 people waiting for them to come back to Ann Arbor after the Iowa victory. So it wasn't unheard of that there were going to be some fans that were going to be there waiting for them, but not 7,000.
Wow.
So the propeller-driven plane lands at Willow Run and starts taxiing toward the main terminal. And all of a sudden, these fans just break down the fence. I don't know what they did exactly, but they ran out on the runway. They were going to greet the team. The pilot of the aircraft got scared because obviously you get too close to the plane and that's a hazard. So he turned around and went back to a hangar. And it's from the hangar that there were a couple of buses that eventually brought the players back to the main terminal. And by that time, some people had thought they weren't going to see the team because the team was not going to come to the terminal. And so they left and they started driving away from the airport. And then they noticed that there were these buses. And then people were stopping their cars and running across the field and to see the players after that. And the celebration went right on down onto campus. It was just, you know, a tremendously, tremendously satisfying victory for everybody.
All hail the conquering heroes.
I quoted one reporter saying the fans took off after the plane like convicts on a prison break after the plane came into sight.
Great, great line. And so it really did break that stranglehold, didn't it?
Yes, it did. I think from 1964 to 1988, that's a 25-year time span, Michigan and Ohio State played 25 times. Michigan won 12. Ohio State won 12. One ended in a tie. We know the year that it ended in a tie, 1973. But there was competitive parity between the two football programs over that length of time. And it really began, I think, with Michigan's victory in 1964 because Ohio State, as you indicated earlier, had pretty well taken control of the rivalry until that 1964 team that kind of reasserted Michigan's competitive role in the rivalry.
Bruce, why do you think this Michigan-Ohio State rivalry is so deep-seated and so intense?
The two programs, you know, historically have been not just at the top in terms of the Big Ten, but they've been at the top nationally. In the 60s, in the 70s and the 80s, let's put it that way, there were so many times when the last game of the year determined the outcome of the Big Ten championship and so forth. There's the geographical rivalry between the two states, obviously, and I'm not familiar with the so-called War of Toledo and all of that that had to do with all of that sort of thing. But I think Ohio State, certainly under Woody Hayes, shall we say, fueled the fire in the sense of saying that was the team that, you know, we wanted to beat. The season wasn't successful unless we beat Michigan. And if the Big Ten championship was on the line, so much more the case. But the rivalry still lives on, let's face it. I think it's the most enduring rivalry in all of sport, certainly all in all of college sports. This game in 1964 illustrated. And I want to bring out something else, if you don't mind.
Sure.
It was a clean game in 1964. There were very few penalties on either side in that game. And yet, you know, one of the Michigan players was quoted as saying it was a typical throat-to-throat struggle for the Big Ten championship and a trip to the Rose Bowl. But it certainly keeps things interesting in November.
It certainly does. An interesting read, The Game That Turned Around the Michigan-Ohio State Rivalry by Bruce Gale-Hood, who is a Ball State University history professor, also the author of Bump Elliott, The Michigan Wolverines and Their Championship Football Season. And you can find his look at this game in November 64 in the current issue of Michigan History Magazine. Bruce, thanks for talking with us today.
Thank you. It certainly was my pleasure.
The Nain Rouge, Detroit's little red hobgoblin, the harbinger of doom and disaster. The legend of the Nain Rouge goes back to the very earliest days of Detroit's history as a French settlement. Now the story of the Nain Rouge is being told through a series of fiction books and a graphic novel and a planned short film. Joseph Bastian is the writer and creator of the Nain Rouge trilogy and the Nain Rouge graphic novel. So good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here.
And Joseph is a partner in Folkteller Publishing with Carl Winans, who's a producer and a digital storyteller. Glad to have you with us, Carl.
Thank you, Cynthia.
Three books and a graphic novel, Joe, and plans for a film. What was it about the legend of the Nain Rouge that just inspired this flood of creativity in you?
Well, there were two things. It was timing and opportunity. It was 2008, 2009. Like a lot of people, I lost my job. And I had heard about the legend before, but never really looked too much into it. So all around me, you know, being a native Detroiter, and I saw things were like, it seemed so dark and so bad.
It was the pit of the recession.
It was a terrible period for so many people. And just by happenstance, the legend came back in my field of vision. So I started doing a deeper dive into it. First of all, it was such an old legend, and I had never heard of it before. And most people that I knew who grew up here had never heard of it before. And then that this was a legend that was so old, but there were only bits and pieces. As I started to do research, there was no backstory about who this creature was or where he came from. It was just, there's this harbinger of doom that appears just prior to bad events. And that was pretty much the story. And that he had run into Cadillac when Cadillac founded Detroit. That was pretty much it. So as a writer and now having the opportunity and the time to invest in that, I was like, wow, this seems like real fertile ground where you could really bring this story to life.
Uncork your imagination. Yeah. And nobody from 300 years ago is going to be around and go, no, that's not what we meant. So really, it was a blank slate for you to play with.
Exactly.
Give us a sense, without giving all the goods away, what did you choose for the Nain Rouge backstory?
Well, the story begins, in literary terms, I love saying this, in medias res, so which means in the middle. So the first book, the action starts right off the bat. There's two middle schoolers that are on a field trip down at the DIA. They end up seeing the Nain Rouge. They're so distraught, they pass out. When they come to, the curator says, listen, I need to talk to you. He takes them aside and says, I know what you saw. He's been appearing more and more, and it's a bad sign for you. It's like seeing a black cat. Mm-hmm. So that's the first few pages. That's how the story begins. So really try to draw the reader in right away. And what the children learn is that there's a curse on the city. And all this bad energy has been building up year after year after year, and now it's manifested in the Nain Rouge, and he's becoming more and more powerful. And what the curse is what happened when the Nain Rouge appeared. He was actually a good force. He was a balancing force in nature, and he was the keeper of the straits, of the narrows between the lakes. So he worked with the natives to cultivate the land. And then when Cadillac came, he showed up at the fort. And he said, he introduced himself and said, hey, you know, I'm the Nain Rouge. My name is Luton. I kind of keep things in harmony and balance, and I'd be happy to work with you to cultivate the land. Well, Cadillac dismissed him and had his men throw him out of the fort and, you know, beat him up and said, I'll take what I want and do what I want. I don't have to listen to you. So the Nain Rouge turned around and he cursed him, and this was his curse. He said, take what you steal and steal what you keep. The shepherd must pay for his sins with his sheep. So fast forward to these two kids, what they learn is they're actually descendants of Cadillac's men, and they're the ransom to the curse.
Oh, my goodness. How great.
And it all culminates on the 300th anniversary of the city of Detroit. So I won't give anything else away, but that's sort of that's the rising action, and that's just the first book.
And it begins Nain Rouge, and then Nain Rouge 2, The Red Tide, and then Nain Rouge 3, The Red Truth. We're talking with writer Joe Bastian, who is the creator of the Nain Rouge trilogy and the Nain Rouge graphic novel, and his partner in Folkteller Publishing, Carl Winans. Carl, does this story, do you believe, speak to people who are not from Southeast Michigan?
Oh, absolutely. It's a universal story, but that's what we find really fascinating about, you know, urban and local legends. And our focus with Folkteller is to take obscure local legends and kind of bring them to life and shining a light on them, letting people feel proud of where they're from and share their stories, but also let other people experience and connect to those stories as well.
And this is something that Carl and I have talked about a lot. We've talked about visualizing literature. I don't think people read less. They read differently. And they read more visually now, and they read in smaller pieces, so they might not go and tackle an entire text-based novel.
Hmm.
In fact, I had one of my best friends said, I gave him a copy of the books, and he said, Joe, he goes, I'm going to be honest with you. I'm not going to read these books, but I'll go see the movie.
Isn't that interesting?
And that just told me a lot, and I was a little insulted.
I'm sure you were.
but that, with that kind of candor, that's how people are. They would much rather, you know, read the graphic novel, which is much more visual, or go see the film. And it's all about the story. That's what we believe, is everyone takes in and receives stories in different ways. And so our goal is to make the story, tell the story, and make it available to as many people as possible.
And speaking of film, you are planning that for the new year?
Mm-hmm.
And you have enlisted actor Martin Kleba, who is originally from Troy, and people have seen him on a lot of TV credits, Pirates of the Caribbean.
Mm-hmm.
So was he approachable and up for this?
Oh, absolutely. We talked to Martin early on in the process, and Martin was, you know, happy to come on board. He was excited about the project, obviously. It was also a great opportunity for him as well.
Fascinating, fascinating. And again, the website is?
Folktellerstories.com.
Joseph Bastian and Carl Winans, you'll have to keep us posted. And as the movie gets put together with Martin Kleba, please keep us updated.
We will. Thank you.
Thank you, Cynthia.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. The Education Achievement Authority has been the center of controversy since first opening. The idea, create a statewide school district to take over and turn around failing schools. The EAA is now in its third year, 15 schools, all in Detroit, and still a very polarizing subject in this state. Michigan isn't the only state where policymakers created statewide school systems to turn around their worst-performing public schools. Tennessee and Louisiana have recovery school districts, RSDs, similar to Michigan's EAA. Nelson Smith's been studying these state turnaround systems for the Thomas Fordham Institute. His most recent report is called Redefining the School District in Michigan. Welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
And Dan Varner is with us. Dan serves on the State Board of Education, and he's head of an organization called Excellent Schools Detroit, seeking ways to make school choice work better in Detroit. Dan Varner, so good to have you with us.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
Nelson, what were you looking at for this report, Redefining the School District in Michigan?
Well, as you noted, this is one of a series, so we're looking primarily at how these statewide turnaround districts affect governance structures in the states that they're located in. So I've been looking at Louisiana and Tennessee, which both have somewhat similar districts, and then this is the third, looking at Michigan. So in addition to looking at the structural relationships, which in this case are pretty complex, pretty convoluted, we also take a look at, you know, achievement and finance and a lot of other facets of how these things are set up and how they're functioning.
Can you give us kind of a broad sense of how this the structure of Michigan's EAA compares with what you've studied in Louisiana and Tennessee?
Yeah, it's more complex. In both Louisiana and Tennessee, you had pretty straightforward passage of laws. Louisiana in 2003, actually, and Tennessee in 2010, where a district was created, and in the case of Louisiana, it was then expanded after Katrina to take in most of the schools in New Orleans. That's the recovery school district. And it right away operated as a state agency and, you know, had the powers of a district, but operating as a state agency. In Tennessee, although the timing was very similar to Michigan, the key difference was that while both states created this statewide district as part of their Race to the Top application, the application for federal education funds in 2010, Tennessee won the grant. They were one of the first states to win right out of the gate, along with Delaware. So they were able to proceed right away with setting up a state agency that functioned as the turnaround district and got off to a faster start. Here, what happened was that because the state didn't win the grant and the agency was created on paper, it didn't exercise any powers as a turnaround district for the whole first year. And then when Governor Snyder arrived, remember that it was originally set up under Governor Granholm, but when Governor Snyder arrived, he decided to get it started through what's called an interlocal agreement, which is essentially a contract between Detroit Public Schools and Eastern Michigan University. This had a lot of other implications. For example, in creating the charter schools that were authorized under the EAA, the funding didn't flow until November of the first year. And if you read the report, there's a lot of legal structure that had to happen in terms of the setup of the actual agency. The biggest difference is that because it wasn't done under a state law that created a functioning district, but it was rather set up as a contract, it is vulnerable to changes. So that, for example, you've had the Detroit School Board, when it briefly had authority in 2012, deciding to try to withdraw from the EAA. It was restored when the emergency manager powers were restored. You've had some discontent at EMU among the students and faculty about their affiliation. And if they withdrew, that would be half of the partnership withdrawing. So there are some vulnerabilities to this structure that are really not present in the other states.
Dan Varner, what would you add to this kind of discussion of the vulnerabilities and problems the EAA faces?
Many of the challenges that the EAA has faced, I think, were very predictable given some of the vulnerabilities that Nelson described, as well as some of the political realities around its initial year of operation. So it was given less than a year to take over operation of some of the most challenged schools in the city and indeed in the state, which is a very, very short timeline. Did not have state appropriation in its first year, and so it was heavily reliant upon philanthropic funding, which left it really without much room for error with regard to financial operation. And then was thrust into, I mean, when it was initially announced, the state had not lifted its cap on charter schools, but that was done just a couple of months later. And so it was initially conceived of as a turnaround district for these really challenged schools, but ultimately attempting to be that was forced to compete for enrollment with other schools. And of course, by its very definition, is serving the most challenged schools.
I'd like to get the thoughts of both of you. What do you think EAA administrators could have or should have done differently in bringing these 15 Detroit schools into the EAA and getting this thing off the ground? Because as you described it in your report, Nelson, it was a rocky opening.
I think time was a real critical factor here, and I certainly respect the urgency with which state leaders approached this. But you do need time to sort of set the process up and make it as transparent as possible to make sure that the funding sources are in order, and then to have some method of making sure that you have enough operational capacity. One of the things that happened in the early going was that because it was not certain how many schools would be chartered and how many would be direct run, I don't think that the central office was really prepared for the takeover of 12 schools, that it would not only run directly, but also schools that where it would install basically a new platform for teaching and learning with this BUZZ system. In my interviews for it, a lot of people in the central office said, yeah, we just did not anticipate what it would take to do that. Now, that wasn't necessarily their fault, I would say. There was just something, as Dan points out, in the timing of the state action and the urgency with getting the schools underway. If you look at Tennessee, for example, their start date was essentially the same. They were able to take a little bit more time to make the decision about which schools they would take, and then they took them in small batches. There have only been 9 or 10 or 11 each year, and then half of those would be chartered, and half of them, roughly speaking, would be direct run. So the capacity load on the agency itself was not overwhelming.
I am talking with Nelson Smith, whose report for the Thomas Fordham Institute looks at redefining the school district in Michigan, looking at Michigan's EAA. And we're talking with Dan Varner, who's the head of Excellent Schools Detroit. They seek ways to make school choice work better in Detroit. You know, there are critics who feel very, very strongly that the Detroit kids in these EAA schools are pretty much being used as guinea pigs. And they point to, for instance, that software program you referred to, Nelson, BUZZ, unveiled as cutting-edge technology, but it had so many bugs and a lot of money's been spent ironing out those bugs. You know, Dan, were those Detroit kids used as guinea pigs?
I think there are two sides to this equation, and both of them are legitimate. They're absolutely both have merit. On the one hand, we're in desperate need of innovation around the way that public education gets delivered in this country. The way that we deliver it certainly doesn't achieve great results for all kids all the time. And for kids of color and low-income kids in particular in this country, the results have been pretty poor, given the amount of resources that we put into the work. So innovation is necessary, and you have to applaud the folks at the EAA for attempting to do that. On the other hand, I think the critique here around the kids being used as guinea pigs, it stems actually out of two things. One was the use of this method. And let's be clear, the method is not unproven. Folks use blended learning all over the country. And the results, generally speaking, are good. They're uneven, but good. Particularly better at elementary schools, which has been true at the EAA as well, but good. This is not a case where we have a completely new, untested form of teaching that's being delivered at the schools. But the accusation is made all the more strong because of the lack of local control, right? Because this was a state takeover. And so you have a sense of kind of the kids being subjected to something different against the will of many in the community who would have preferred for the schools to remain under local control.
Nelson, what are your thoughts?
I somewhat dismiss the argument that kids were guinea pigs because of the mess that did happen and things didn't roll out perfectly. Anytime you're going to be trying a fundamentally new technology, you're going to have some hits and misses, and there are going to be things that have to be fixed. So, yeah, I guess in that sense, it's too bad for the kids who have to live through this. On the other hand, I mean, I've heard the complaints of the teachers about certain software not being available on time and things like that. But then I've also talked to others and principals in the system who were very enthusiastic about the capability of this thing, specifically to reach the kids where they are. And that's sort of the great virtue of it. That's what blended learning is all about, and having these systems that are delivering content geared to where the kid actually is and then building them up. One of the key things about the whole academic performance of the EAA, which is really hard to get a handle on, is are they learning? Are the students making progress? And some of the critics say, well, they're not reaching proficiency like they should, and there's some truth to that. But on the other hand, the focus of the EAA administration in the early years was very much on stimulating student growth, because they were coming in from so far behind that they had to find out where the students were in their learning curve and then meet them there and then move them to the next level. And that's what this platform was designed to do. So that's why, I mean, it has gained a lot of very positive notice around the country. The Gates Foundation made several grants to support it. I think there's a lot of interest in it from that perspective. But I can also see the argument, particularly, as Dan says, because of the local control aspect, that there was some suffering in the classrooms as this thing was being developed and rolled out.
I want to look at some of the storm clouds that have gathered. We saw 24% of the kids didn't return for the 2013-2014 school year. That's nothing to do with political. That's kids voting with their feet. You have Eastern Michigan University, as you mentioned, fielding complaints from faculty and students about the school's partnership. The board is going to reevaluate the contract and could possibly bow out. And that bill that would allow the EAA to expand stalled out in Michigan's legislature earlier this year. What does that tell both of you about the EAA's future?
The EAA has plenty of enemies on the left and the right, which makes it a little unique. Because the workforce was not presumptively organized, and because the local teachers union in Detroit, the Detroit Federation of Teachers, had entered into a pretty progressive agreement with DPS right before the EAA was created, the unions have felt like it didn't need to be created, and so they've been opposed to it. Those who plant their flag around the issue of local control are opposed to it because of the loss of local control, of course. And so you have a number of folks on the left opposed to it, and then you have what I might call kind of unregulated education marketplace advocate who would prefer to see a charter school kind of solution offered, opposed to it on the right. I think its political future is very much kind of up in the air. It'll be hard work for this governor, who has said that the EAA codification of it has been one of his primary objectives. It'll be hard work for him to actually get it codified, which leaves one with a lot of questions about how it continues. I might say in that regard that the governance of this thing is probably, to me, less important than the potential to learn from any, you know, good that has happened in the classroom. At the end of the day, this has to be about kids learning. Ms. Nelson said, getting to the root of whether and how effectively kids are learning in the EAA is very difficult to do. It depends on which assessment you look at and whether you're looking at growth or proficiency. I think we'll all learn much more with the spring administration of the new state assessment in 2015. But if it is working, I mean, if we can get to that assessment and get results from that assessment and we see that kids are learning and so on, then we should all be trying to figure out how to take what's been done there and apply it elsewhere. And if it's not, frankly, then, you know, we should be looking to figure out how to either reform it, like one of the reform solutions, or to go in a different direction altogether. But at the end of the day, this really should be about kids, and kids who've been largely failed otherwise.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly, and I do think that the spring administration of the MEEP is going to be pretty critical because, you know, you've had this very strange situation in the state generally where the assessments are given in October rather than in the spring, which is when most other states do it. So it's hard to get a good handle on exactly what is being measured. So this year, you'll really be looking at a year or even a year and a half worth of time. And remember that the EAA has had these schools consistently now for, this is the third year. In the other states that do this, you typically have schools coming in each year. That's certainly the case in Tennessee. But the EAA has been supervising these schools for 3 years in a row now. So you really do want to see some proficiency growth, and that's what the MEEP measures. Even though the student-level growth, as measured by the other tests, the performance series tests that the EAA administers, has looked pretty good, the needle hasn't moved on proficiency in the first 2 years. And so this is a year that I think is going to be critical. One other quick point on the question you asked, Cynthia. It does look like this year the enrollment decline has been stemmed. Preliminary estimates for this year look like they're going to exceed their projections for enrollment this year by a little bit, not a huge amount. So if people were voting with their feet, maybe that has stopped a little bit. They did take a number of measures to try and specifically address the high school students who were having some trouble with the Buzz platform, but also just having difficulties with the extended calendar because of other things that they wanted to do in their summers, for example. So whatever the measures were, they seem to have worked for now at least.
Knowing you've been doing these comparisons, looking at other states, looking at Michigan, Nelson, what lessons should other states take away from Michigan's EAA?
Well, I guess my first recommendation is one that, you know, may sound easier than it really is, which is get a law. I really do think the governance, although it's not our primary focus, as Dan says, is important, particularly if you're looking for something that's going to get results over a period of time. You can't be kind of looking over your shoulder all the time at whether the thing is going to fall apart. So, number one, I think it's important that a statewide strategy be developed. I mean, one of the things that's happened here is that this is a statewide program, which has essentially stalled in Detroit because it hasn't been able to get to the legislature in any expanded version for the past 3 years. So I think it's important to sort of decide as a state how you're going to attack the problem of low-performing schools throughout the state. The second thing is they have to run a tight ship. I am very happy to see the steps that the new chancellor, Veronica Conforme, has taken in terms of tightening up on things like expense accounts and all of that. Although there are two sides to that story that came out in June, the fact is that it left a bad taste in people's mouths. And because some of the difficulties with the finances in the first year, people got the impression that the thing was not being run well. I think it, you know, they tightened up considerably, but you have to really have impeccable financial management, particularly when you're trying to, you know, set a better example than the system that schools are coming out of. The third thing is communications. I was really struck when I was up there and talking to people at the fact that everybody told me, including John Covington and others within the EAA, that they all feel they didn't do a very good job of explaining what they were up to, especially in the early going. Now, you can't just issue press releases and overcome a lot of political resentment and difficulties and all of that, but you can certainly be clearer about what your goals are, what the expectations should be, and what the processes are going to be that you're going to use. You want to be very, very transparent about, for example, how you're deciding to choose between the option of chartering and the option of using a direct management approach. So those are some of the things that I would say for other states that they really have to think about.
And Dan Varner, do you see a future for the EAA throughout Michigan? There are other failing schools throughout Michigan. Does the EAA have a place there?
I would argue that it only would have a place if, in fact, the outcomes for kids are good. So one of the challenges with the previous attempts to codify the legislation has been that it's also incorporated efforts to expand it. And many have criticized those efforts because the efforts to expand it were done before we had any indication of whether or not student learning was improving. You know, I think that folks in Flint might not be opposed to it if, in fact, it proves out as being effective for kids. On the other hand, if it proves out as not being effective, then nobody should want it, and folks in Detroit shouldn't want it either.
Dan Varner is head of Excellent Schools Detroit. Nelson Smith's report for the Thomas Fordham Institute is called Redefining the School District in Michigan. Dan Varner, Nelson Smith, thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Today's Stateside was directed by Allie Billings. Our executive producer is Zoe Clark, and our engineer today was Peg Watson. Contributors are Mike Blank, Zach Dederman, Emily Fox, Haley Hirschman, Mercedes Mejia, and Annie Norris. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.
Support for the next idea on Stateside comes from Michigan Economic Development Corporation, committed to marketing Michigan to drive job growth and investment in our communities. MichiganBusiness.org.